we have the evening ritual of the questions. Because being a monk, yes, always I have my things I want to say, but it's nice that you take control of the talks by having questions. And even the Buddha said, for those of you who are devout Buddhists, who went to Dhamma school when you were kids, the Buddha said it's not only Dhamma Sawanang, which is listening to the Dhamma, it's also Dhamma Sakacha, which is discussing the Dhamma, question and answer. So here we go. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I appreciate the principle of it's not the sound disturbs you, you disturb the sound. Nonetheless. That's a very silly, nonetheless. You can't have less than none. So, it says N-U-N, the less. Nonetheless. And that is very impossible. You can't say things like that to our lovely nuns. Anyway, did the Buddha say sound is one of the last obstacles preventing from people entering jhana? Can you please comment? If you disturb that sound, it could be the last obstacle. If you can just leave it alone, what happens after a while disturbing sounds? If you don't give them importance, then they just, basically they fall off the radar, as the saying goes. You just don't perceive them anymore because they're not important for you. There are so many other sounds which should be disturbing you, but they don't. I was going to tell the story yesterday or this morning, but I never got round to it. And the reason was, there was many other stories, but that was the story of this Malaysian couple living here in Perth. I've told this story before because I've only been around a certain number of years. You can't have a new story every time. You have to repeat the old ones, but this is actually true, and it tells you what the purpose of my answer is about disturbing sounds and sounds not disturbing you. This Malaysian couple were at home watching the TV, and it was a very good movie, and once the movie had finished, they got up to have a cup of tea, go to the toilet, and it was only then that they noticed there were many things missing in the lounge room where they were watching the TV. Even right behind them, many things, valuable things, were missing on the shelf. The burglar had been into their house while they were watching the TV, and this cheeky burglar had taken stuff from right behind the sofa when they were sitting on the sofa. Absolutely true story. So, the burglar must have made some sounds, taking stuff off the shelf, but they were so focused on the TV, they never heard anything. And that may not have happened to you precisely, say, in that story, but I'm sure that many times you, maybe Sri Lankan men, have been watching the cricket. Oh, you women have been watching a really important movie. Oh, you're watching something or other. And isn't it the case? Your wife says, darling, the lunch is ready. And you just can't hear her. Look, wives, it's not that he's not listening to you. He just cannot hear you. He's in like cricket samadhi. Oh, you're in movie absorption if you're watching a movie. And so they're not sort of being nasty to you, it's just they just can't hear. So that is just like in jhana, just really absorbed into the bliss. You can't even hear the sounds. So it is very much the case that you actually go out to pick up those sounds. The sounds don't actually come and disturb you. You disturb the sounds. Now, this was one of the insights which I had many years ago. And it really is really quite humiliating when I first understood this. I always thought that these random thoughts just came into my mind from nowhere. I was pretty peaceful and the thought would come up, where on earth did that come from? But now, after many years of meditating, mindfulness has improved enormously. I see these thoughts don't come in uninvited. You open the door and say, come in, thoughts. Any old thought will do. usually interesting ones, but even boring ones will do. As I wrote in one of the books, once you run out of interesting thoughts, then you go to the boring ones. Just like when sometimes you used to watch the TV. And yeah, you've got interesting programs, but even if it's not an interesting program, any old program will do. Simply because you are bored. Not content. And that discontent means you go out looking for something to disturb yourself. These thoughts don't come in uninvited. You actually go out looking for them. It's the same with sounds. If you really are content, you know, inside, then the sounds can't come in. What happens is you're not totally content yet. So you go look for something, anything to disturb yourself, even a sound. That's where they come in. Dear your roundness, Ajahn. That is one of my sobriquets, your roundness. And I think you understand why. And at the last United Nations Day of Waisak we held in Perth, when Ayahasapanya was there, and it was a really cold day, we were sitting down there, and she asked me, and this is all seriousness, she asked me, she said, are you going to be around next week? And I say, I am round every day. Can you please share with us the quickest way of letting go so we can let go a lot more in this retreat? Yes, the quickest way is to become a nun or a monk. Was that actually written by a nun? I think it was, wasn't it? I can tell this is nun's writing. The quickest way of letting go so we can let go a lot more in this retreat is don't try to let go. And see if you can, one of the quickest ways is, if you're a nun, but there's nobody in there anyway. Who's doing this meditation? You know the five groups, the five khandhas, the body, the vedana, the perception, the will, the consciousness. These aren't you. So who is doing the meditation? No one is. So there's no one doing the meditation. Just don't do anything. So when you come from a place of no self, no one in there, nothing to do anyway. Who's going to achieve enlightenment anyway? There's no one in there. So, one of the best ways is no one in there. So your meditation is not your meditation. It's none of your business. So that's what one of my great mantras. None of my business. I'm getting sleepy, none of my business. I'm getting nimittas, none of my business. I'm getting jhanas, none of my business. I'm flying through the air, none of my business. Nothing is my business. When it's not your business, you let it go. How many of you, all these other businesses which we have in this world, there's so many stuff going on, I just say it's none of my business. Whatever happens in the nuns' monastery, I've let go of that now because I've supported you enough. So I don't know whatever problems you have over there. Don't, in your interviews, don't come and tell me about all the problems in Dhammasara. If you do, it is none of my business. It's your business. I'm a monk. I'm not a nun. So it's your business now. So I like this bit of none of my business, because, or the Newbury Buddhist Monastery, there's a few people from there here today, I've got nothing to do with that, none of my business, so don't bother me with it, okay, none of my business. It's lovely when none of your business, that means letting go, so that's wonderful, that's the best way, try the mantra, none of my business, my body is none of my business, looks after itself. My mind is none of my business. Not my mind. Have you ever heard of Tonglen meditation? Literally, somebody mentioned this just a few days ago. It's only the second time I've heard about it. Where was that? That was, who knows, overseas in England. Amazing. It's only the second time in my life I've heard about this Tonglen meditation. Take it in and out. You imagine breathing in negative qualities for yourself and others, and breathe out positive qualities. At first it seemed counterintuitive to breathe in negative qualities, but it feels good. Any thoughts? If it works, is it okay? Sounds a bit stupid to me. Haven't you got enough negative qualities already? Why do you want to breathe in a few more? So if you want to, that's fine. You can breathe in my negative qualities, or the nun's negative qualities, everyone else's negative qualities. I haven't heard that before. It's not anything to do with original Buddhism. So I think it's supposed to be compassion. So taking everybody's negative qualities, but you don't do that. You can't take someone else's bad karma away, unfortunately. You can teach them how to deal with it, but you can't just suddenly decide, okay, I'm going to take on your bad karma. So it's a little bit sort of dubious, but if it's developing compassion, compassion is good, but you can't imagine that through that you are decreasing the amount of negativity in the world. That cannot be done that way. Anyway, if it works, you feel good, why not? Dear Ajahn, when you talk about the doer and the knower, is the knower universal consciousness? No, it's not universal consciousness. We all have our own types of consciousnesses. And the knower is the sixth of the consciousnesses, and it's not universal. If it was universal, it wouldn't be able to stop. And you have to be conscious all the time. And that really sucks, because you can't just be conscious of bliss. You have to be conscious of suffering as well. The two always go together. That is why they call it vijnana. Vi is the same as bi. And there's always a duality there. It's like bicycle, binary. It's always two. Because it has to divide. So actually to know something, it's always measuring and comparing with stuff. That's why to be conscious is to compare. Start with light, happiness with suffering. So if it's universal conscious, that would really suck. Unfortunately, it's not universal. It is subject to ceasing. It is disappearing. So your consciousness can stop and disappear, and the universe carries on. Monks and nuns meditate as part of life. Is there any monks or nuns around the world have dementia at all? I can't remember. What was the question anyway? What am I doing here? Actually, I've never seen monks with dementia. So, do you have any record about this? Basically, it'd be a wonderful piece of research for someone to do. So actually to find a good sample of monks or nuns and see how many of them have got dementia. How does one meditate if the heart feels heavy? Okay, lay down. And then it's not so heavy anymore. The bed will support you. If you mean metaphorically heavy rather than actually physically heavy, in other words, you have lots of problems and troubles in your life, then present moment awareness. All your problems and difficulties are all in the past, for goodness sake. They're old news. They're reruns of old movies. They're just same old, you've seen it before, here it comes again. Aren't you fed up with reruns? And that is one of the reasons. The other one is you're afraid of the future. What's going to happen to the world now Mr. Trump is president? Oh, I'm going to be in big trouble. I better become a monk or a nun. We should have a lot more people want to become monks and nuns in the US now Mr. Trump is president. So it's got a good thing. Anyway, we don't know what's going to happen. You know the story, the good, bad, who knows story about the emperor who cut his finger, and eventually the doctor had to cut the finger off, amputate it. Wow, what a tragedy that was. He lost his finger. But, you know, if you want to read the story, it's in one of the books. In the end, that saved the king's life. Losing a finger, he thought it was really bad, but it ended up, surprisingly, saving the man's life. So Mr. Trump becoming president? Good? Bad? Who knows? Are you buying that? You're not buying it, are you? But that's the best I've got to answer. You don't know what's going to happen. So, the heart feels heavy only because you're carrying something. So, what do? You have to throw things away. So, if your heart feels heavy because there's so much stuff you're carrying around with you as you come into this retreat, Just say let go is usually not enough. You can't do it. So we have a Buddhist ceremony with many rites and rituals in Buddhism, you know, lighting candles, bowing and sort of all that sort of stuff. We also have the letting go ceremony. So to do that, you need not flowers and incense. You need some paper and some brown ink. And the particular type of paper, you will find many bits of this paper in this retreat center, is called toilet paper. So to do the letting go ceremony, toilet paper and a brown pen. And all the reason why your heart feels heavy. You write all of that down on the toilet paper. Every reason why your heart feels heavy. Someone's let you down. You're afraid of Mr. Trump being the president. You're afraid of some biopsy result you haven't got yet. All the stuff which makes you feel heavy. You actually write that down. And of course you know the story. It is association. Basic psychology. We associate. So toilet paper. Something brown on the toilet paper. What is that association? You know what I'm talking about. It's shit, isn't it? So that's what usually goes on toilet paper. So brown ink, all the stuff you're worried about, all the stuff from the past which you're carrying around with you, brown ink, toilet paper, write it all down. That's part one of the ceremony. Part two of the ceremony, you've got to go to the shrine. The place where you sit down. And sitting on the shrine, you know what I'm talking about, you read out all the stuff which makes your heart heavy. Just to reinforce, toilet paper, something brown, obvious, what do you do next? You put that toilet paper with all that brown stuff on it into the bowl. And then you do the final part, part three of the letting go ceremony. You press the little knob on top of the toilet and whoosh! All of that stuff which makes you heavy goes round the bend into the sewers, gone forever. That is called the Buddhist letting go ceremony. And it actually works because if it's association, it's doing something, letting go. Like sometimes, you know, when somebody dies, we get balloons and we just let them go. Or you get like birds and doves and let them go. And apparently that happened at Nolamara Center, our city center. So one of the funerals we did there, just to let the spirit fly to heaven. They released all these beautiful white doves and they all flew away except for one who decided he'd like to stay in our center. Had enough with flying back to the funeral parlor and coming somewhere else and flying back again. So he stayed at Lynn's house. He was there for months. I don't know if it's still there. It's there before the range retreat. So this white dove decided to retire. And couldn't choose a better place. Is it still there, Dibby? White dove. I used to be there before the range retreat. It was always around there. So you see it on a Saturday morning, just hanging around there. It was, you know, he had a job before, you know, working for the funeral director, and now decided to renounce and join the temple. So anyway, that's how you ceremonies to let go of things. This is ceremony. So your heart doesn't feel heavy. Now, it may feel like a joke. Many things I say sound like jokes only so you can remember them. It actually works. But please, don't everyone do it here in Jhana Grove. The toilets will get clogged up. So wait till you go home or a public toilet or somewhere. How does someone develop acceptance of situations in life? First of all, if there's something to do, you try and do something about it. So, for example, if there is a fire, you don't just say, oh, let go, let go. Call the fire brigade. If you break your leg, you don't say, oh, my goodness, my leg is broken. It must be some karma from the past life. I mustn't interfere with this. Don't take me to hospital. No, take yourself to hospital. If there's something you can do, then do it. But if there's nothing you can do, then that's when we have to accept it. And that's such an easy thing to do. And often when there's nothing you can do in life about situations, that is sometimes the best, to learn how just to learn to live with them, make peace with them. Make peace, be calm, be gentle to these situations. You'll find The situations in life, the real suffering, is not what life gives you, but how you deal with what life gives you. And sometimes the situations in life which is most difficult are the ones we learn the most from. The more smelly is the shit in life, the more powerful it is as a fertilizer for your wisdom and compassion. So you have situations in life, use them for learning and growth. If I want to learn and do chanting, which chant should I learn and why? Okay, there is some chants which are really, really helpful, such as the chant which you do when you are meditating. It's like called a mantra. You do it with your breath. As you breathe in, you chant shut. As you breathe out, up. Shut up, shut up. To tell your mind to stop thinking, for goodness sake. But if you want to do a Buddhist chant instead of an Ajahn Brahm city chant, the Metta Sutra is one of the very best, the one we do over here. It's in English, you can understand it, and it has great meaning. And listen to that chant. What does it actually say? It says, this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness. May I be contented and easily satisfied, not proud and demanding in nature. So are you content with your meditation yet? Or are you still trying to improve? Are you easily satisfied or really demanding? Asking Bianca, can you make this food? Can you make that food? Can you make it different? Can I have this? Can I have that? Are you demanding in nature or are you easily satisfied? And if you wanted to be a good meditator, learn how to be content and easily satisfied. Not demanding and having to get jhanas or at least nimittas, otherwise complaining. No, just to be able to be here and meditate. Have 8 or 9 days in a nice peaceful place. What more can you want? That is enough. Anything extra is just gravy, as they say. So this is one of the nicest chants. It has a huge number of very, very good teachings in there. And what is recollection of Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha important for us? Why? It is, first of all, a Buddha, the great teacher. Everything which I say was because of Ajahn Chah brainwashed me into this. And Ajahn Mun brainwashed Ajahn Chah. And if you actually look back where it all came from, it came from the Buddha. So he started all of this brainwashing business, all about learning how to let go. For 6 years he was struggling, striving, putting in immense effort and getting nowhere. And then he remembered being under the rose apple tree as a young boy, watching his father doing a ceremony, relaxing, not doing anything, just basically killing time. He wasn't striving under the rose apple tree. He was just relaxing, letting go. Nothing to do. His father was busy. And that type of letting go, contentment, was what got him into a jhana for the first time. And all this struggling and striving and putting forth immense effort, he realized that wasn't getting him anywhere. And this other way was. So it's incredible insight. So often in any spiritual life, we always have what's called spiritual materialism. Wanting to get stuff. Wanting to improve yourselves. Wanting to go back from this retreat, and when someone says, what did you get on this retreat? You can actually tell them, oh, I got deeper meditation, I got great insight, I got nimittas, I got jhanas, I got this, I got that. That is gomayan. So really, if your people you associate with are real Buddhists, they won't say what you gained in this retreat. So what did you let go of in this retreat? What did you let go of? I let go of all this struggling and all this striving and all this tension and all this stress. That's what I let go of. Good. It's not what you get. It's what you let go of. So that stops the spiritual materialism. So that was also a great insight by the Buddha. And the Dhamma is the teachings, that's why we recollect the teachings. Without those teachings, some of them just are so incredible when you really get your mind around them. Where else can you get incredible teachings to let go and be still? Sometimes it's just quite humbling just to see these teachings, just how far they go and just how powerful they are. They really are powerful. If you still got this email, Jimmy, remember you sent me an email. You send me emails from people who say thank you for all the talks and stuff. There was one email from a lady in Eastern Europe, which you sent to me, saying that because of the meditation, she cured her arthritis. And basically, she was a middle-aged elderly lady in Eastern Europe, having to take painkillers, strong ones, every day, just to get through the day, because arthritis is an incredibly painful disease. And she did the meditation, and the arthritis is gone. Doesn't need any painkillers anymore. Totally vanished. And that was just, I've never heard anything like that before, that arthritis can be totally healed through this meditation. That was incredible. Because I've known people with arthritis, and it's one of the most painful, debilitating diseases. And there's no cure for it. So I thought. So this Dhamma is incredibly powerful. It gives people their lives back when they're being tortured by arthritis. And so it's powerful stuff. And the Sangha are the monks and the nuns who keep these traditions going. You know, they're the holders of, they pass the baton like in the relay of the Olympic torch, keeping the Dharma going for future generations. So that's why, recollect those qualities, that's really amazing. So that's my answer to that. Dear Ajahn, have you ever met an enlightened person? Do they exist? Would I recognize one? There could be one sitting right next to you right now. Would you recognize them? Number one, if they said they were enlightened, that is an obvious case that they can't be. How can someone say that they are enlightened? What is enlightened? Is it their body enlightened? Is it their nose which is enlightened? Is it, what is enlightened? So, there was one of the suttas from the texts where monk came up to the Buddha. Ananda was sitting next to the Buddha, being his attendant, and this monk said to the Buddha, he said, someone who is fully enlightened never thinks they're better than anybody else, never thinks they're the same as anybody else, never thinks they're worse than anybody else. The Buddha said, yes, exactly, well done, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. He didn't do the three big sadhus, that's my invention, just all these sadhus. And another monk came and said exactly the same. Someone who's enlightened, they don't think they're better, worse, or the same as everybody else. And the Buddha said, yes, correct, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And then when the second monk left, the Buddha turned around to Ananda and said, those were two new arahats, two new enlightened ones. That's how they tell me of their attainment. They don't come up and say, I am enlightened, look at me. They don't say, please confirm my enlightenment. They just say, well, there's no one there anymore. So they're not better, they're not worse, they're not the same. They're just not there anymore, not measured. So that tells you what an enlightened person is. They never think they're better than anybody else. They never think they're the same as anybody else or worse than anybody else. They're not there anymore. So that gives you an idea of how to recognize an enlightened one. They don't have like a badge on them, like enlightened. We don't have stripes on our monk shoulders. No, one stripe for stream winner, two stripes for once returner, three stripes for non-returner, and a big pip or a star or crown, whatever you put, for a full arahat. We don't have that. So you cannot know which nun amongst those nuns is fully enlightened, or whether none of them are. Can you know? Can you tell which monk is enlightened and which monk isn't enlightened? Can you really know? Yeah, there's lots of myths which go around, but they will never, ever be confirmed. And one of the reasons is this. This is a story from when I was a young monk. Oh, you know that some of the food we used to eat in those days was really disgusting. They're all frog on rice, those sorts of stories. And I'd only been in Wat Pa Pong maybe about 4 or 5 months, and the food was disgusting. Usually rotten fish curry every day with the sticky rice, nothing much else. And this day, it was called rotten fish because it was rotten. And it smelt rotten, it tasted rotten. If any ever a food deserved its name, that did. And this one day, I was sitting in the dining room, this long hall with like 2 rows on either side, I looked through the window and a big car, like a ute, turned up. You know, one of these cars with a big tray in the back. And in the tray was full of saucepans. Someone from town was making a dana offering. There's not a whole lot of monks. There's a lot of monks there, so there's many, many saucepans. And I knew this must have come not from the village. This came from town. So I thought, wow, today I'm going to eat well. Not any of that rotten fish curry and frogs. Proper food. And I was already salivating when the guy came out of the cab, came into the hall and asked the monks, where's Ajahn Chah? And they said, he's gone off to a dana in somebody's house. And so the man got in his car and drove away. You could smell the food, but he took it all away. I will never forget that. I was traumatized. Really, I should have gone for counseling after that. And the reason why was because, yeah, giving to Ajahn Chah, you get some good merit for that. You get bang for your bucks. It's a good investment. You know, but giving to ordinary monks, that's not worth anything at all. So he just took it all away and just tried to find out where Ajahn Chah was and give it to him. He had heaps of stuff. So us poor nobodies, we got nothing. We had to starve. That's what happens. People think, and it's true, it does say that if you give a donation, such as a cup of tea to an arahat, wow, that's huge good karma back for you. Even if it's to a non-returner, even a stream winner, that's huge good karma. But giving it to an ordinary person, that's sort of okay, but nowhere near as best return for your investment. Which is why a lot of people, especially places like Tandam, I think it's probably maybe the same in Sri Lanka as well, they try and find out, who are the enlightened ones? And they get fat. They get really fancy monasteries. And the really other ones, they just get nothing. They get thinner and thinner. Which is one of the reasons why we make sure we don't encourage that at all. We will not tell you who's enlightened and who's not, because that will happen. And sometimes you don't know who's enlightened. In the time of the Buddha, they had these little novice monks, same as they have them now in Thailand and Sri Lanka. We don't have them here because they're too much of a pain in the butt for teaching. They are. But anyway, this novice in the Buddha, sort of, you know, he's just a young novice, and so some of the monks were teasing him. I think his name was Sumana, the novice. They were teasing him. And when the Buddha saw him, you know, pulling his ears and tweaking his nose, the Buddha called a meeting. He said, monks, I want to meet with you. And he said, that novice is fully enlightened. Not only that, he's got enormous psychic powers. And he just, a few days earlier, this novice had this big battle with one of these Nagas, these psychic beings, and defeated the Naga. And he said, this little novice is huge power. He could just waste you just so easily. So don't always think that you know who's enlightened and who's not enlightened, just because they just ordained or because they're tiny novices. And as a result of that, that's where the Buddha told that well-known story of the 4 small things you must always be careful of. Now, the small snake, the baby snake can still be venomous. Just because it's tiny doesn't mean it can't give you a really bad bite. And the small fire can turn into a huge bushfire, as you all know here in Western Australia. And a small prince can one day become A small business person can one day become the President of the United States. So you've got to be careful, because they remember it was a small prince. And lastly, a small monk or small nun. Just because they're young, they're just ordained, you don't know whether they're enlightened or not. So that's why the four small things. And you can't tell, and deliberately we don't let you know, otherwise it will split the Sangha up. Those people who are enlightened, or streaming as white returners, non-returners, or arahats, we have the word for those, they're called Aryas. The Arya. And that's why we don't tell anybody, because otherwise we'd split the Sangha into two. The ordinary monks and nuns, and the Aryastocracy. So we don't have an Aryastocracy. No sort of two tiers. So everyone is looked upon as being the same. So have I ever, going back to the question, which is a good thing to do, is have I ever seen an enlightened being? Of course you have. So someone like an Ajahn Chah, because I was with him for 9 years, I stayed with Ajahn Chah, you could check him out. And over 9 years, never saw anything which would make you doubt, but lots of things which really impressed you about an Ajahn Chah. I can say about him because I was with him for such a long time. Other people, oh, they look really, really great monks. They look like arahats, but you can never really know because you never see them all the time. But Ajahn Chah, but the story which really tipped me over, suspected for a long time, but what really tipped me over was when, after being a monk with him for a long time, he asked me to go into his private quarters to get something for him. And usually he's only have his novice, the one who attends on him, is allowed inside his private quarters, no one else. So the first time in my life, I was going to Ajahn Chah's room to see what he had in there. And that was just an amazing experience, because there was nothing there. His room just had a mat, one of the straw mats, a wooden pillow, and one robe on the line, and I think that's about it. And he was a really famous monk. At this time, generals, the queen had been to see him, so he should have had anything you needed in there, but there's nothing. When I saw that, I thought, wow, there's a person who had the ability to have so many requisites, so much stuff, the most expensive stuff, people would be giving it to him, but in his room where he lived, it was empty. That's a sign of a great monk or a great nun. That's one of the reasons why, when we have our big ceremonies, entry to the reins, Katina ceremony, we always invite people to go and have a look in monks' huts, and nuns' huts as well. Would you be proud and happy to get people to have a look in your private quarters and to see how little you have? Or would you be embarrassed, like some monks actually lock their doors on those days? So what you need to lock your door for? What is the difference between compassion and pity? I think pity means, P-I-T-Y, it means you're looking down on people. It's like, I am better than you. Maybe, I pity you. But real compassion is, it is actually feeling what it must be like to be in their shoes. So it does actually, you do feel with them. I think pity is feeling for them. Compassion, feeling with them. Just a quick answer. Dear Ajahn, is walking meditation better than sex? Does it lead to jhanas? Okay, it can lead to jhanas, but usually when you start doing walking meditation, you start getting peaceful, then just sit down. Because while you're walking, the posture is a bit too gross to get into deep meditation. What is a good method to practice walking meditation, fast or slow? What meditation object is suitable, etc.? It's usually you watch the feelings in your feet. So you start off doing walking meditation, present moment awareness, silence. If you want to, you can go to what I was saying this morning, to have a look at the peaceometer or the stressometer that somebody said today in your mind, to make sure you are relaxing as you're doing the walking, not stressing out anymore. And present moment awareness, silence, and then just watch the feelings in the feet as the feet move. I'll say more about this later on. are the various stages in walking meditation we should be aware of that it indicates correct practice, i.e. peace, joy, bliss. Yeah, peace, joy and bliss all come. I'll do more about walking meditation tomorrow morning because it's an important part. Dear Ajahn, you are an expert on hay fever. Is it worse in the daytime and less in the evening? If so, why can't we have the retreat in the night and sleep by the day? Many of you are doing that already. Yeah, it's usually worse in the morning, hay fever, and it gets much better afterwards. But it's just the day, sometimes it's hot, sometimes it just changes all the time. So, again, you can do that if you wish. You can actually meditate all night and sleep during the daytime. Regarding the person who was dying in the Murdoch Hospice, probably he shouldn't have gone home to receive the same old treatment and to die 6 months later. I think when he went home, he realized that now he could eat whatever he wanted. But, you know, he was very sick. His life was at the end. He just got an extra 6 months just because of joy and happiness. Sometimes it's just when there's no fun in life, no happiness in life, that makes you depressed and that just stops the immune system. I have a question on right livelihood. My daughter's study work involves killing small animals for scientific research. Being a Buddhist, what is the skillful way to handle this dilemma without giving up the work? Thank you. Small animals, and that means like rats and mice and stuff, because that's probably what usually it is. If she can sometimes find some suicidal mice, first of all, mice who don't mind dying. Now, maybe old mice, you know, their only alternative is to go into an old mice home, an old people's home. So if it's actually, that's what we used to do when we catch mice, because there's mice in all over the place in this forest. So, you know, we had mouse traps over in Bodhinyana Monastery. And so when we catch the mouse, you know, the Buddhist mouse traps, they didn't kill it. What do we do with it now? We caught the mouse. Now what? So we found this wonderful solution, because you all know just a little bit up the road from here, about 6 kilometers, is a prison. So we decided to release all the mice in prison, because that's bad karma, stealing from a monastery, and you have to go to jail. So all the mice who stole food from Bodhiyada Monastery ended up in the prison up the road. That's actually true. We used to release them up there. it felt appropriate. But so if it is really necessary, so her research, I mean, is really making a difference. But saving the lives of many, many, many people and also animals, fine. But sometimes if there's another way, then it's best to try and limit the killing of animals as much as we possibly can. Limit it, but sometimes we can't totally stop it. I remember as a young monk seeing all these terrible experiments which were done, and one which really revolted me, and still remember it. They were doing research on monkeys because they wanted to develop better helmets for American football. And they were just putting these prototype helmets on these poor monkeys and slamming them headfirst into a wall. And it was just because of the sport of American football. I thought, that is just really, really too far. That's really gross. There's no justification for that. But if it's like a mouse is going to, you know, stop a lot of people dying from malaria, then maybe that's a good thing. I'm not sure. So limit it. And if there's another way of doing it, fine. A lot of times there's other ways of doing it using biological cultures. Anyway, dear Ajahn, who decides which food can be eaten in the afternoon? In the time of the Buddha, there were no cheese, chocolate or marshmallows in Asia, so there must be another authority. Exactly. Now, the way it works is, if it wasn't clearly, specifically, directly prohibited, then it's allowed. So, because there weren't any cheese, chocolate or marshmallows in the time of the Buddha, therefore the Buddha never prohibited it. You've got the argument. That's how people work. But if the Buddha actually said it, and there's no way around it, oh, crikey, we can't get around that one. So, you know, you're stuffed. So, that's actually how it works. In practice. Could you please explain how the five aggregates and the six sense bases relate to each other? It seems like the mind includes vijnana, sankhara, and sanya, while the other five senses are related to the rupa, kanda, and vedana. I'm a bit confused. That's a tough one. I'll do that tomorrow as well. How many heavens are there in all as per the Buddha's teachings? Oh, there's huge numbers. And sometimes you have those lists of heavens, and there's some which you read in the suttas which aren't actually mentioned in those lists of, what is it, 37 or I forget how many heavens. But because they have like the devas, the heavenly beings who enjoy play. And that's actually mentioned in the suttas, but it's actually not in the usual list. So the point is the number of heavens there are is not strictly limited. In other words, you can make new heavens and new hells to suit yourself. For example, we have like the Tawatingsa heaven, which is one of the best known in Buddhist cosmology. And in the Tawatingsa heaven, the boss over there, Sakka, one of the gods, he had this palace. And in the palace, there were some like 1,000 turrets, and every turret had 1,000 rooms, and every room had 1,000 beautiful women. Because that's man's fantasy. And so it's supposed to be a heaven. Maybe for him, but not for the women. So what is going on? Were those women actually heavenly beings? They can't be heavenly beings. The same as, what's the Muslim, that you, if you die as a terrorist, you get reborn in heaven with how many virgins? It's not much fun for the virgins. But actually, a Muslim told me this joke, so it should be okay. Heaven used to be such a peaceful place and really safe. But these days, in heaven, you've got to really watch your step. There's so many terrorists up there, you don't know where the next bomb's going to go off. He did tell me that joke. Anyway, you create the heaven to suit you. So what heaven do you think you deserve? I remember reading the Quran a long time ago, and their heavens were like beautiful green fields and lots of water. And to me that was like where I lived in England on a summer's day. And the English idea of heaven was nice sandy beaches with palm trees. And that's, you know, where the Arabs lived. Because we always think the other side is beautiful and wonderful. Paradise. So when I saw that, I mean, I said, you create the heaven for what you think you deserve and how you like it. So, this is actually mind-made realms. And we keep on making mind-made realms. So, yeah, there may have been that many realms in the time of the Buddha, but there's many more now. You make your own to suit you. What you think you deserve. What you think is enjoyable and fun. You can understand why stupid people, you know, think that just having so many virgins is good fun. They think that just having, you know, that harp music is good fun. I would hate harp music. Some good rock music might be okay, but harp music, I can never understand that. When I sort of heard about Christian heaven, I said, I don't want to go there. Ambrosia, no fish and chips, no mushy peas. Just ambrosia for breakfast, lunch and dinner every day. People wearing the same old white clothes. You know, no sort of fashion, as fashion hasn't changed in all those years. So, it was obviously, that's how people visualized heaven a long, long time ago. So that's the heaven they would make for themselves. That's what they would expect and what they want. These days, the heaven will be much more for what you want. What you deserve. It's mind-made realm. But, You talked about the importance of listening to our bodies. When it comes to eating, the quantity we eat, the craving for that sweet after a lunch, how do we know whether it is the body that needs it or whether it's our greed or desire? So this is when you're mindful of your body rather than mindful of your greed and desire. It's pretty simple to know the difference between the two. One is you just want it for pleasure. The other one you realize is wanting it for health. I recently went to Thailand on holiday and saw a ladyboy cabaret. Crikey, can't you spend your time a better way than ladyboy cabarets? Anyway, whatever. Is a ladyboy trans person someone who was reborn in the wrong body? Could be. That's a possibility that they are before, that these are the transgender, and that's just who they are, and you find that if they do dress what they think the gender they are, and they do act in the gender they are rather than the gender they were born with, they're usually far better human beings. So if that's what a person needs to do to have a peaceful life, fine. And it could be they were a female before who's been born as a boy, or the opposite. Sometimes that there was a case of that here. This was a little boy, Charlie, who died when he was just as he was born. And he, 5 days before, that's right, 5 days before the birth, had an ultrasound. Everything was going well. And when the baby was born, it was stillborn because it had twisted in the womb and it had cut off the blood supply on the umbilical cord. So it was a stillbirth. It's just one of those really unfortunate incidents. So I went to the funeral. I did the funeral service for this family. And when I wasn't watching, they told me afterwards, when the funeral director wasn't watching, they took a blue ballpoint pen and drew a line on Charlie's heel. And the mother was a healthy woman, so she soon became pregnant again and gave birth to a healthy daughter called Anne. And Anne has got a birthmark on her heel, exactly as they put on the former child. Is Charlie come back again? And when they told me that, I was really looking at Anne. And she, I knew that she was a girl in her previous life, a boy in her previous life, now born as a girl. And she was what, you know, you call a tomboy. She would always want to play with the boys, beat up the girls, even though she was a girl herself. She had all the characteristics in her early years of being a male in a girl's body. And I knew she was a girl. She was a boy before. Get confused. An even better story, in one of the forest monasteries in the north of Thailand, that one of the donors went to the market, and in the market they saw one of these poor little monkeys in a cage have been really abused. It's supposed to be Buddhist countries, but some of the way the Buddhists treat little animals is disgusting. So out of compassion, they brought the monkey and wanted to release it in the forest monastery so it could be sort of safe. So this was a monkey really couldn't sort of look after itself, you know, because it had been in captivity. So it eventually got used to being around the monks. So much so that every time it was tea time in the afternoon, the monkey would also come and would have to have his own cup of tea. It was really cute to see all the monks there having a cup of tea and the little monkey having his tea as well. He really associated with those monks because the monks were kind to him. But he was also really protective. So protective that when he said that people would come from Bangkok, and if anyone was cheeky with the head monk, the monkey would actually go into first person's lap and let it be petted. It's just nice, you know, stroking little monkey. Then he would go into the next person, he could stroke it. Then he would go into the lap of the person who'd been cheeky to the monk and then bite that person. Now, he'd always tend to do that because, you know, it was really protective. And if there's any cars outside the monastery, he would try and chase them away. And that's how it got killed, chasing a truck and fell under the wheels and got killed. But the head monk of that monastery, you know, he had really good meditation. He saw what happened. The stream of consciousness of that monkey left the body because it was killed, went into the village and into the belly of one of the women who was pregnant. So the monk saw that. His mistake was telling the monks what had happened. So all the monks, they told me they were waiting and waiting for this woman to give birth to find out what would come out. Because according to this, what this this head monk, a really good monk, that was a monkey before their friend. And now it's being reborn as a human being. And what they told me when it came out was that baby was extraordinarily, much more than you would expect, hairy. It was a monkey before, and now it's got to be a human being. So if ever you give birth, or you know, your daughters or nieces, nephews, nieces give birth, and it comes out hairy, you know what it was before. Anyway, so also, are the two stupas outside situated north-south directions, or were they randomly situated outside the lunchroom? Totally random situated. That's where they sat, outside the in this little area, to make it a little bit Buddhist. But those are stupas from the same stone as the great Buddhist monument Borobudur in Java. So exactly the same stones, exactly the same type of Buddhist statue. And if ever you go to Borobudur in Java and you go to that great monument, you'll be told by the guide, sort of you might call it a superstition, but the belief associated with those Buddhas inside the stupas. And the belief is this, that if you can get onto that stupa and you can reach inside, and if you can actually touch the Buddha inside, then, according to the tradition, you will find true love. So if any of you do that, and I see you, I will tell your husband or your wife what you're up to and embarrass you. That's what they used to say. So be careful, now I've told you. If I see you putting your hand in there trying to touch the Buddha, I know what you're up to. Explain how to do the walking meditation, that's for tomorrow. I always try to apply the principle of contentment. If you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. But my husband tells me that this is being lazy. He believes one needs to dream big, aspire to improve, aim higher. Please comment. Well, you always, like in a marriage, in a relationship, you have to have the coming together of opposites. So you can be the lazy one, and he can do the big dreaming, and he can do all the hard work. So that's sharing of responsibilities. Which is what matters. So, husband, you can dream big, and I'll be discontent. I think that's very good. Just like in the monastery, that, you know, many people need to cook, but somebody needs to do the eating, and that's the monks. That's a sharing of responsibilities. Okay, I'm losing my... Okay. Oh, yeah, these are the ones. Walking meditation, yeah. Only a few more. It's 9:05, should finish off quickly. Please tell us about the two stupas next to the meditation hall, the significance of how they came here. It's amazing. One of the things which I've noticed on these retreats, you get questions, the same question or really similar, and they go into the box almost next to each other. The synchronicity is really weird. It's as if somebody has a thought and somebody else picks up on that thought and asks the same question. This happens every time, every retreat. It's going to happen again, and I'll point it out again. Two totally different handwriting, and all about the stupas outside the meditation hall. Weird stuff. How can you tell the difference whether you're being disciplined, sticking to the daily schedule, letting go of wanting to do it your way, or just being a control freak? You tell the difference if you're relaxing, if your peaceometer is going higher in peace and less in stress. So check that out, and you find if you're a control freak, you get more stressed. If you are letting go, you get more peaceful, and you can feel that. I am fearful of letting go, but I know that holding on is even harder. Sometimes when I'm meditating, I feel like I'm about to fall. I want to scream out loud, but instead I come out of my meditation. I wonder what would happen if I fell. And is this me falling asleep during meditation, or is it part of the meditation? A lot of time that is actually part of the meditation, feeling of falling or going into something. Let it go. You're perfectly safe. And in this meditation, you can't hurt yourself. It's like the story of the two men on top of the cliff. I told this in London recently. Two people on top of a cliff. Vertical cliff. Right on the edge. And one had a budgerigar in a cage. He was holding it. And the other one had a parrot on his shoulder. And the guy with the budgerigar in a cage, jumped off the cliff. Jumped off. And the budgerigar, the little canary in the cage, realized, because the guy was holding on to it, that they would both crash to the ground and even the budgerigar would get killed. And so the budgerigar started flapping his wings. Now it would be easy for the budgerigar to be able to fly, but he had to carry the guy's weight as well. So this budgerigar was flapping for everything it was worth. And it was actually working. The guy was actually slowing down because of the budgerigar flapping his wings harder and harder, and the budgerigar was still going to be touch and go, so the budgerigar was flapping his wings as hard as he possibly could, and the guy was slowing down, wouldn't it be enough, flapping even harder, this poor budgerigar was almost killing itself, and it worked. By the time they reached the bottom, all this guy needed to do was just to bend his knees to take the fall and stand up. As for the budgerigar, he was on his back, panting, barely alive, saving himself and his boss. Poor budgerigar. And then it was the other guy's turn. The guy with the parrot on the shoulder jumped off. The parrot was on a string, so it couldn't fly away by itself. And halfway down, going at top speed, this man got out a gun and shot the parrot dead. Bang! And then, amazingly, he started slowing down. Slowed down even better than the other guy. And so he didn't even need to bend his legs. He just landed like a feather on the ground. And the two looked at each other. And the first said, this bungee jumping is good, but it's not as good as parachuting. That's the worst pun joke I know. Bungee jumping and parachuting. What did I tell that story for anyway? What was I going for? I don't know. Anyway, it's a good story about parachuting. Oh yeah, about falling. Don't you take a bungee with you when you're falling in meditation? Or shoot the parrot, you'll be safe. No, just go for it. Just go for it. You won't get into any trouble. Is it possible to be greedy for the Dhamma? I notice I'm getting anxious and tense for wanting to get on an Ajahn Brahm retreat and for wanting to listen to Ajahn Brahm live. Oh, come on, aren't you fed up with it already after one day? So are these things we should let go of as well? Yes. Should I never come back to Jhana Grove as an act of renunciation so that others may take my place on your retreats? No. Or would that be silly? Yes. I let him go of the raft before I've crossed the other side. Correct. So just don't think too much. If you really need to come on a retreat, come, and if your karma is ripe, you'll get on. If it's not ripe, you don't get on. Sometimes, you know, there's a waiting list, and sometimes people put they're the last person on the waiting list. It just happens. There's an opening. It just happens that day, and you just get on straight away. So it's amazing sometimes how people get on these retreats. So, but don't sort of worry about, it's all the same old story. Some of you have been here on so many retreats, you've heard it before. And hear it live, what's the difference between live and on the YouTube? So anyway, so yeah, if you want to, you can. But it's best not to be too greedy for the Dhamma. Because instead of listening to it, just practice it. So you can actually get so much Dhamma inside of you, but not actually practice it. Just like the story of, you know, the old story of the professor of philosophy and the new restaurant opening up. It's my last story in the second book, the Grumpy Book. Because there was, people are just so hungry for Dhamma, they just read so many books, they go online, they listen to so many talks. How many talks do you need to listen to, for goodness sake? But there was a professor of philosophy, and he heard that a new restaurant had opened up in town, 5-star restaurant, with a Michelin-rated chef. So he immediately sort of got on the telephone and tried to make an appointment. It's like as hard as getting on one of my retreats. He had to wait for 2 months until there was a table. He said, I'll take it. So 2 months went past. So a really top restaurant. He had to, you know, really dress up for it. So he put on a nice suit, a nice tie, cleaned himself up, and turned up at the restaurant. And the maitre d' on the outside asked for his ID to make sure he had a reservation. Checked his ID. Yes, sir, you know, you have a reservation for tonight. Please come in. And took him to the table. Mahogany table. Just the furnishings were just so exquisite. Chandeliers. Everything was gold trimmed. It was just amazing. And the light was just enough so he could see where he was going, but soft enough to be intimate, like a good restaurant should. And he sat him down. A few minutes later, the waiter came with the menu. And the guy was dressed like a butler. And he gave him the menu in thick card with red border and gold letters on it, like calligraphy. It was really a high-class restaurant. And the professor said thank you to the waiter. And then the professor continued to eat the menu. Then he paid his bill and left. Because the professor of philosophy did not know the difference between the menu and the food. And the meaning of that story is that sometimes the menu is all the Dhamma talks, all this stuff which you read and you learn and you listen to. That's not the food, that's the menu. So once you've read the menu, eat the food. Otherwise you'll end up hungry like that stupid professor. So enough menu for tonight. Now, dine. Sadhu. 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 Very good. So have a wonderful night, everybody. If you need to go and do flat-out meditation, your bed awaits you. And see you in the morning.